You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 26th of September to the 2nd of October 2013. Yes, it's October already. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by Deputy Features Editor Paul Jump, writer Matthew Rice and Books Editor Karen Shook. Our lead story this week looks again at allegation of universities gaming the Research Excellence Framework. We will have a look closer at that in a second. Our cover feature asks where, if anywhere, the study of William Shakespeare can go next. Matthew will have more on that. And we'll also hear what lies in store for readers of this week's ever-popular books section. But first, our resident ref expert Paul Jump is on hand to tell us a little bit more about our splash this week, and it relates to the number of academics recruited in the UK on so-called 0.2 contracts. For those who don't know, Paul, what are these and how does it relate to the REF?
Well, 0.2 contracts are just, they're the minimum contract that you need to have in order to be entered to the REF, and it just means that you spend a fifth of your time at the relevant institution. Evidently, you know, people that are employed on 0.2 contracts only get 0.2 of the salary, so it can be seen, you know, recruiting large numbers of these people might be seen as a sort of cheap and relatively easy way for universities to boost their REF entries, particularly because just because they're on 0.2 contracts doesn't mean that they can submit fewer outputs to the REF. They submit the same as anybody else. So, you know, you hear dark rumblings about certain institutions possibly using this as a way to essentially cheat. So I just thought it'd be interesting to sort of get the actual figures on this. So I did an FOI request of every UK university, and I asked them how many academics they've recruited on 0.2 contracts in the last 2 years and in the 2 years before that, in order to compare it. And not surprisingly, I did find that in the most recent 2 years, it's gone up a lot. It's gone up by 63%, which, you know, your natural assumption would be to assume that's because of the REF. It's also, though, worth saying that the sort of raw numbers aren't huge. We're still only talking about 1,200 academics recruited on 0.2 contracts in the last 2 years. So they're not massive numbers. So you might say that although, you know, perhaps people are trying to cheat the system, evidently those kinds of numbers probably aren't going to see huge distortions in the final outputs.
No, is it more pronounced in the more research intensive universities?
It is, although the one with the most that recruited the most academics on 0.2 contracts was Hertfordshire, funnily enough. 75 they recruited. Although most of the other big players, yes, are the research intensive: King's, Manchester, Cambridge. Cambridge recruited 428% more academics on 0.2 contracts in the last 2 years, although that still only amounts to 37, so let's not get carried away.
Surely, though, if you had an eye on a particular department, even a small number of people could make a difference, say, for one specific faculty or subject area. Would that not be the case? And if you, presumably, you're recruiting specific people who happen to have four very strong outputs or the right number.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. It may be that the devil would be in even greater in looking at that in even greater detail and looking at it unit of assessment by unit of assessment. Yeah, that could well be true. I should also say there's some interesting excuses for not releasing figures.
I was going to ask you that. Some universities have ignored the FOI request. Others actually explained why they flat refused to respond, didn't they?
Yeah, one said it would take them more than 18 hours. To compile the figures. I'm not sure what staff they've got working for them. Evidently, they're not very efficient.
Maybe it's where they're keeping their figures.
Yeah. Another said they weren't going to release it because HESA were going to release it after the REF submission date, which was sort of news to me. But my favourite excuse was from Imperial, that said releasing the figures would potentially affect their research funding and therefore compromise their commercial interests. I didn't quite follow that one either.
No, that commercial interest is a reason we get a lot. We had a podcast a number of months back, actually, with David Matthews, one of our writers, who was explaining some of the barriers that we journalists hit when trying to get the information we need. And it's interesting you mentioned Hertfordshire there, actually. I met Quinton McKellar and talked to him a bit about the impact of REF on his institution. And he played it down, actually, saying, you know, it's more of a case, more of an issue for the more research-intensive institutions. But there is a podcast of that interview available if you want to listen to his response to that in full. Just go to the podcast page on our website. But Matthew, you had this week's cover feature, which looks at the study of William Shakespeare. One line from your article perhaps sums up what your article is about, at least in part. It says, "We've had lots of Christian and Marxist Shakespeares, psychoanalytic, deconstructed and postmodern Shakespeares, postcolonial and queer Shakespeares." What is it your feature delves into?
Well, I think one of the things is that Shakespeare is such a kind of icon of the English-speaking world that whenever there's a new school of critical theory or new tool of analysis, it tends to get applied to Shakespeare. And at the same time, you've obviously got people doing more traditional research on the architecture of Elizabethan theatres and things like that. And so the two groups, you know, they kind of accuse each other of being antiquarian on one side or newfangled on the other. And so that often there's a sort of element of conflict or distrust between different groupings. And obviously the really big question is, you know, how much is there still to say about Shakespeare, the relatively small body of work which has been analysed in enormous detail over centuries, and, you know, several publishers bring out complete editions of the plays, and when they get to the end, they start again. And, you know, how many individual lines are there still new interpretations of their meanings, which no one had thought of before. And some of the plays have only one, you know, early text. So to get the text right is pretty straightforward. And then, you know, how much more is there to say about the meaning of Hamlet or King Lear?
Mm. What kind of response do you get from these academics when you put that challenge to them?
Well, I think they do say that every generation has new questions, and certainly questions about, say, homosexuality in Shakespeare or race in Shakespeare are more than legitimate and interesting questions, and that we do reinterpret the Elizabethan and Jacobean ages all the time. And that the whole thing of performance history, now a lot of editions include performance history. And of course this is great for publishers, because as soon as one edition comes out, there's some, you know, famous new production and they have to update the book. But on the other hand, I think it's probably true that, you know, a major production with epoch-making performance by Kenneth Branagh or something is important for the future productions of the play. So there is an element that updating is legitimate.
Mm. And reception theory can fill in the gaps. When you've gone through every other version, you can talk about why people interpreted things the way they did at different times. So it does seem endless.
Yes, that's true. I mean, there's a lot about, as it were, trying to get at what Shakespeare meant in his time and the way that it's been reinterpreted over the ages. And, of course, you know, productions on the stage put Shakespeare in every different... We've had a lot of productions of Shakespeare set in Iraq or Afghanistan, and why not? And to some extent, academics are reinterpreting in similar sorts of ways.
Mm, mm, yeah, plenty more fuel in the Shakespeare tank, it sounds. Karen, we should move on to you. Usually I have a chance to see the book section before this podcast. We're recording a little bit earlier this week, so I'm in the dark. Maybe you can enlighten me as to what we can expect this week.
Well, our books of the week are destined to be classics, of course, I would always claim, but this week's book of the week is probably amongst the most classic of the classics, because it's about the classics. This week we review Thomas Pavelle's The Lives of the Novel, A History. Thomas Pavelle is an American academic who was born in Bucharest, and our reviewer Robert Eaglestone says this book is a major intervention. In academic speak, of course, that means a really good thing. And he thinks it'll be the standard work in the field. Now, Pavelle grew up, as he said to me, in a place where it was a little bit dangerous to opt for one specific writer as your field of study, because if they fell out of favor, you were really in trouble. So perhaps this is why he looks at 100 different novels in this book. Of course, he long since moved to America and the Iron Curtain has fallen, but he's a Proust man, he's a Samuel Richardson man, all 1,500 pages of Pamela, so undergraduates may be inspired by his example. He's a little bit critical of
or
Joyce.
Terrified.
Yes, but probably the most interesting thrust of this book is that while anyone who's done even a first-year course in English literature or an A-level course will remember, we have all been taught that the novel begins with Don Quixote. Everything else before that was some inferior genre. But Pavel looks as far back as ancient Greek novels. Yes, for those of you who didn't know, there were ancient Greek novels. He's talking about Heliodorus, goes on to look at a number of things that predate Don Quixote and analyzes those and says that they have all fed into the idea of the novel. But most refreshingly, and for someone who is a structuralist and interested in linguistics, because that was slightly safer than opting to support certain novelists in Romania, he says, when I read a novel, I want to see what happens, who does what, who gets ahead, who marries whom, and why. And I think that's probably refreshing for those of you who didn't study English literature and fancy that it's all full of terrible post-structuralist things. Funnily enough, this book was first written in French, and his reputation in the Francophonie as a scholar of some weight is quite high. So that may put paid to the idea that the French interpretation of literature is only to make things more opaque. Also this week, Sally Munt reviews a book by Colin Johnson called Just Queer Folks, Gender and Sexuality in Rural America, which makes the interesting point that, in fact, the received notion that you had to get to the city if you were gay and that there were areas of tolerance there that you wouldn't find in the country isn't necessarily borne out by a study of early 20th century America, where towns protected their own and a lot of people lived non-heterosexual lives without being oppressed. And the author said, and he grew up in Illinois in the country, Colin Johnson, and he said, I spent much of my own adolescence misreading the homophobia I encountered there as being somehow uniquely local in origin. As I would later discover, it wasn't local, it was everywhere.
Interesting stuff as ever. Before we go, I should point out that our second feature this week is by Russell Foster and looks at the importance of optimism in research. His boundless enthusiasm is demonstrated in his tale of what happened when, as a child, he found his view of specimens through his first microscope obscured by his eyelashes. His solution? He chopped off his eyelashes. We have a slightly shorter issue review this week, but we're not shortchanging you. Just under a week away are the 2013-14 Times Higher Education World University Rankings. They'll be out at 9 p.m. on Wednesday, the 2nd of October, and we'll have a special podcast for you then. Before I go, I should also say thanks to Elizabeth Gibney, who covered in on this podcast for the 2 weeks while I was away. But until next week, thanks for listening to this week's issue review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.